I want to start by a question that I answered to someone, and I hate to answer in the corners because then nobody else benefits from my answer. Anyway, I like to answer it collectively, because that way, if someone doesn't like my answer, they have the possibility to respond or decide my answer. So, someone asked me, what about the use of the term democracy of human rights? And I'm saying, he's saying, well, why are you using these terms? And I'm saying, well, I mentioned something about this in the discussion yesterday, where I don't remember if it was yesterday or the first day. It was on someone that asked me the same question: why not using other terms? And the thing is that I refuse to let Eurocentric fundamentalism define a certain concept as if they were Europeans. For example, concept of democracy, I mentioned, is first Greek before the Greeks before, you know, 5 centuries before Christ. That's an invention of Eurocentric modernity to trace them as the origins of European civilization, when in fact Greece was not European at the time. That's a great invention to think that Greece was Europe. Europe did not exist. The West did not exist. These are more contemporary identities after 1492. 5 centuries before Christ, that was a complete different world. And as a matter of fact, if you read Martin Bernal, Black Athena, you will see there how the Greeks were highly influenced by Persians, Phoenicians, and Egyptians. You know, and Egyptians had a lot of Bantu civilization, you know, very strong. And so to say, and the Greeks were a crossover of all these different civilizations and cosmologies. And to say that that's Europe is an attempt by this Eurocentric modernity to put a narrative there about origins, a mythological origin, that obscures, you know, and that basically, you know, to place itself as superior beings, you know. And if you watch carefully that history I mentioned the other day, there is a gap there, because there is the Dark Ages and Middle Ages. What does that mean, Dark Ages, Middle Ages? I don't know. And that's where I mentioned that that's Islam. And if they acknowledge that that's Islamic civilization at the center of the world at the time, and as a central component inside this territory we call Europe today, that they were here, and that's how Greeks arrived over here, you know, because at the time you read Aristotle, you would be burned alive. Okay, at the time this was forbidden by the church. Aristotle was, you risk your life if you read Aristotle. And the same thing with Greek philosophers. While obscurantist Europe was burning people alive for doing science or for doing having knowledges that question the dogmas of the church, the Islamic civilization were already dealing with all these questions, including Greek philosophers. It's through Greek philosophers, it's through Islamic philosophers that this philosophy was maintained and brought to this part of the world. But when with the ego conquerus, I conquered, therefore I exist, after 1492, and the structures of superiority inferiority that were built around it, with epistemic racism, economic, political racism, etc., then there is the need to create a foundational myth that traces back European civilization to the Greeks. And this is an invention. This is an invention. There's not nothing real about it. It's just an invented tradition to precisely erase erase Islamic civilization from the picture. Because if they will acknowledge that the Greeks arrived through Islamic philosophers, okay, to this part of the world, that the medicine, scientific medicine, arrives through Islam, that astronomy arrives through Islam, that physics arrives through Islam, mathematics, algebra, all these things arrive through Islam, then the idea, the myth of the West of building itself by its own bootstrap, okay, this myth, this Cartesian myth of, you know, you build yourself and your knowledge in internal monologue and, you know, in with an ethereal mind that is not determined by anybody, then you have no depths with anybody. You see, you are self-fulfilling kind of entity that you self-produce yourself in a complete autonomous way with no depth with anybody. That's what then brings ontologically the claim to superiority, because then you have built this knowledge, nobody else has achieved it, you erase the history of everybody else who have, you know, brought this knowledge to you, and then you could make a very strong claim about superiority inferiority. This is what is behind this whole mythology about the origins in Greece. And then that's why I refuse, and if you summon the word democracy, this is a word done by Enrique Dussel, democracy is Egyptian word, it's not even Greek, you know. So I'm saying this because I refuse to give up certain terms that the West have appropriated as if it was naturally inherently Western, you see, and then give up on that and say, oh yes, that's, well, that's, you know, I'm not using democracy or human rights because that's a Western thing. I refuse to do that. I think that's exactly what many third world Eurocentric fundamentalists do, you know, that they give up on the binaries of the West and they accept them as given instead of displacing them, you know. And so that's why I keep words like epistemology, democracy, even human rights. There are notions of human dignity in all cultures and civilizations. They're there, but the problem is when the West kidnap the concept of human dignity and make it with a very particularistic definition to then pretend to be universal, okay? That pretend to be universal. This is the problem. So to decolonize notion of human rights or notion of democracy is not to throw away democracy or human rights. It's to redefine them in a pluriversal ways. This is the way to go. Because who said that the West had the monopoly of the concept of democracy or human rights? They don't have the monopoly. And they don't have even the sole definition of that or the sole practice of that. So there are other ways of thinking about it. Therefore, I think it would be falling in the mythology to say that democracy and human rights are Western and we shouldn't use this. You know, I think we should use it. That there are other ways of calling this? Yes, there are. And maybe at some point we will use that too. I don't know. You know, maybe we move on into a different context and use other words. And there are other civilization or other epistemologies that have concepts that that are not exactly the same word, democracy, but they are referring to the same thing, to the same process of people deciding collectively over things, you know. And so the self-governing of people and people deciding over who leads them or what kind of decision they're going to make collectively and things like that. So there are other ways of thinking about this in many other cultures and many other epistemologies. So the West don't have the monopoly of that, and in other places might use different words for the same thing. That's fine. But right now, the word democracy and human rights has been used as a kind of, in the Eurocentric modernity, is a way to communicate right now. And what we need to do is not to throw it away, but to redefine it. That's my goal. Let's redefine it in ways that are more universal rather than universal. Right now, the project of human rights and democracy are imperial global design. They're used as tools and mechanisms to intervene in many places around the world in very, very imperialistic ways. Because they will look to the side when there's a regime there that they want to keep there, you know, even though they will do the most outrageous atrocities to its own people, but it's an ally of the West, they don't do anything or say anything. But then when it's a country that they don't like, or it's an enemy or semi-enemy of the West, then they will then apply the book of human rights and democracy and things like that, you see. So this is why it becomes very perverse, because it's a tool used. The human rights and democracy is instrumentalized, you see, in imperial colonial design to just intervene in the benefit of Western powers everywhere. That's why it's so inconsistent, the application of this human rights thing. Look, Saudi Arabia is one of the most crazy places in terms of all kind of issues, you know. Nobody talks about it in the press, you know, or in public opinion. This is like silent. Why? Because it's a major ally of the West there, you know. And, you know, there until very recently, women could not even drive a car. I think still, I mean, something like that. It's very repressive regime and very. But nobody talks about Saudi Arabia. You see, but it's not a major issue for the West to go after the Saudi kingdom. Okay, other places that are defined as enemies, then they apply the book, you know, completely there. I'm not saying there are no problems of human rights. There are problems of, there are atrocities happening everywhere. But why is it there's no book applied to the U.S.? U.S. have right now the largest incarcerated population in the world, even though it doesn't have the largest population in the world. Because you might say, well, this is the largest country in the world. Well, of course, they might have the largest number of people in jail. But no. Communist China have 5 times the population of the U.S., and the U.S. have more people in jail than Communist China. Okay? And 70% of the people in jail in the U.S. are people of color, Latino and blacks. 70%. So how could you go around preaching human rights and invading country for human rights when in your own backyard you have extreme violations of human rights happening in crazy ways? Talking about zone of non-being. Listen, in the U.S. there are zones of non-being where people's rights do not exist in the zone of non-being. It's violence and appropriation as a constant. Okay? And so this is the project of human rights is a very, very, it's an imperialist project. That's why I'm very skeptical of this project of human rights and the project, and also the discourse about democracy. It's an imperial project. When places where that are doing the job for the West, they overlook it. They look to the other side, you know. And these are, you know, terrible dictatorships, you know. And then other places that might be more democratic, then they go after them. Like, look at Chavez in Venezuela. This is amazing. This guy has been elected and re-elected more times than anybody else. This guy has is the only constitution, democratic constitution, where the opposition can get signatures. You know, to get elected today, in 2 years, I get the signatures and revoke you in a referendum. It's the only constitution that has that. And the opposition has used this over and over again, and he keeps winning the elections. And the elections are clean. He has international people going there to check out. Everybody has said these are clean elections. It's not stealing votes. There's no political prisoners in Venezuela. There's freedom of speech, freedom of press. The majority of the press is opposed to Chavez and work freely. Okay? No people disappear. No people kill. Look at the campaign that you read in Western press about Chavez in Venezuela. And nothing to do. It's just crazy. And it's a democratic regime. Even Carter had gone there to watch the election and come out publicly saying these are clean elections, nothing to say. And so these are, I'm just giving you an example of how there is this campaign against Chavez, but against Saudi Arabia, there's nothing, you know? So what is this thing about human rights and democracy? It's a hypocrisy. It's a tool used you know, at their own convenience. That's why I see it as an imperial global design. Apart from the fact that it's always this universal definition of those terms that are used also, you know. But it's, even within that definition, Chavez will be, you know, a democratic regime. There's no way to question that. But then they will come up with ways to say, oh no, this is not democratic, this guy is a terrorist, this guy is this and that, and all kind of things, you know. So, anyway.
Okay, Sabina has a question.
I want to address three issues, but now that you are talking about Venezuela, I want to address more. I will just attach to the first three that I've got, mostly regarding to the Camilo Sánchez Batista in Mexico. I don't think that this general embodied determination of knowledge would be enough. And actually, I don't see a problem of knowledge generation in these zones defined by Enrique Luso that are not inside of the system. But the problem I see, and a question that I don't see there, is what happens when these knowledges are produced in these areas, in these non-being areas, defined as you have said these 3 days, and then they are subsumed again and neutralized by this world system. And this is also something that we can see through the Zapatistas as well. And this is, I think, a key question that is not embedded inside of that model, but it's not problematized. Because I don't see, again, a problem of all these emerging knowledges, which are actually not pure indigenous in the sense of originated in this kind of songs, but also mestizo. But this is the second point I was going to address. The point is, how would you not forget the power relationships inside all that? You know, right?
Were you here yesterday?
Yes, I was here.
Okay. Did you see all the power structures I was mentioning?
Sure. Yeah. Actually, therefore, I am addressing that question. I don't see a problem of knowledge generation in those areas. I see a problem when that knowledge arrived to this public arena and then it's swallowed by the system again and therefore neutralized. I mean, there is no critique to that thing. And all that happened to the Zapatistas.
I don't think that's what happened to the Zapatistas.
Okay.
I think that's another story, what happened to the Zapatistas.
Okay. Let's put separate, regardless of the fact that that happened or not to the Zapatistas. In theoretical terms, what would you say about that?
What I would say is that there is a debate today, in especially between Marxists and vis-a-vis some post-structuralist trends and things like that, Marxists and post-structuralists, both together, questioning issues of identity, like deconstructing identity. For example, you have Zizek, Jameson, and other Marxists saying, listen, today in multinational capitalism, what you have is a situation in which companies use identities and commodify identities to sell products. And so what they do is that they swallow into the logic of capital identities of anything. Okay? And some post-structuralists will agree with that point, that identity is not exactly a point of departure for producing any kind of alternative anti-systemic knowledge, because it could be swallowed up by the system. Okay? It could be commodified, it could be incorporated into a hegemonic process in the Gramscian sense, it could be used this way. Now, the point I'm going to, my claim is the following, which is in a sense similar to many of the indigenous claims in America, which is that if you think of identity in the most superficial way, that is, identity in terms of the way you dress or the way you look, you know, the type of hair, you know, the way you put your hair, the way you, in the most visible signs of identity, that could be commodified like this. Okay, so if you think of identity as the signs of identification, that could be commodified in a second, and they could be reselling to you the same signs you are putting forward as some kind of anti-systemic thing. The thing is that for indigenous people in Americas, identity is not just that. Identity relates to questions of coloniality of being and coloniality of knowledge, not just coloniality of power. Yesterday we discussed coloniality of power. I haven't discussed yet coloniality of being and coloniality of knowledge. We have discussed, but not coloniality of being. Coloniality of being refers to ways of existing that have been inferiorized, okay, by this. For those who were not here yesterday, I don't talk anymore about global capitalism. I think that's a very terrible term. I prefer to talk about capitalist, patriarchal, modern colonial, Western-centric, Christian-centric world system. At the risk of sounding ridiculous, I prefer to use a long phrase like that to put forward what is at stake, okay, than world capitalism or global capitalism that just reduces everything into one single aspect. And I prefer to keep the attention into this, all these multiple power relations that are involved in the system we live, and make them visible in the way we name it. So I prefer to sound ridiculous and use a phrase like that to avoid the economic reductionism that is implied when you call this system global capitalism or capitalist world system. So what is lost from sight in many of the Marxist approaches, even post-structuralist approaches, is the epistemic diversity. That is, the ways of being and the ways of thinking that are implied in that relative exteriority. It's not absolute, but it's a relative exteriority that the system cannot swallow up. Give you an example. The Zapatistas, your same example. The system cannot swallow up the concept of democracy of the Zapatistas. It will imply a major revolutionary transformation of the system if you swallow that up. You see the point? When you think about commanding well-being, okay, as a way of thinking about democracy, it's a completely different concept from the West. So they cannot swallow that up. There are epistemologies, ways of thinking, ways of existing that are different, that have not been subsumed by the colonial project of the West, that have a relative autonomy from the West, that are not absolutely exterior, but are relatively exterior, okay, that from here are difficult to be seen, okay, that exist in many parts of the world, and that, for example, indigenous communities is a good example of that. Now, if you think about identity in this most superficial way of, you know, signs of identification, yes, that's swallowed by commodity, by the commodity.
I'm not just thinking in the commodity example, I'm also thinking in other ways of the system of solving things. For example, in Mexico, political discourse changed very much after the Zapatistas, and this is also a way of taking some ideas, of course not radically, as we would like to, but taking some ideas and changing the discourse, and that has kind of an effect of, okay, this changed, this had effects. Or for instance, in the university, in European universities, the idea of start looking at that as a phenomenon and just producing studies, dissertations and theses as a way of trying to swallow that, but of course not taking that seriously into account. But there is always something that is, you know, in this commodity stuff, that the system can somehow not try to be aware of it.
I see your point. You're talking about hegemonic strategies.
Yeah, exactly.
But the problem with hegemonic strategies is that they cannot fully subsume the epistemology of these subjectivities. This
not
is the problem.
Fully, but
it cannot. For example, let's say, for example, the concept of nature.
That is my concern.
Yeah, but
it is enough not to neutralize it.
It is what?
It is enough. I mean, these tiny things are enough to neutralize.
You're reading of Zapatismo here. It's, you know, no, wait a minute. It's the problem with the neutralization of the Zapatismo is have nothing to do with a successful hegemonic strategy. It has to do with political tactical mistakes of the Zapatismo, which is another story. That's what I was saying. I'm looking at the Zapatista revolution from the point of view of the what is the epistemic project behind it. I'm not looking at the tactics or things like that, because then we can do a thorough evaluation and find a lot of problems and mistakes. Because when you go into politics, your hands get dirty and then you make mistakes. That happened. Now, if we have studied the French Revolution as the source for political philosophy all over the place, and we make the categories of the French Revolution the categories of political philosophy, why not making the Zapatista Revolution a revolution from where we can produce political philosophy that is decolonial rather than colonial? You know, so the point I'm trying to say is that there are things of the Zapatista Revolution that the system cannot swallow up. Because if they swallow that up, it will destroy itself, you see? Take, for example, the discussion I'm trying to say about nature. Were you here the other day? I was discussing the concept of nature, the Western concept of nature. The Pachamama, as a concept, the system cannot swallow that up. Because it will imply a destruction of the system. You see, the system cannot work with that logic of Pachamama.
So what happens to this logic?
I'm sorry?
So what happens to this logic? It gets no power.
The logic, this is the problem, the issue of this logic then is the building of political movements that are anti-systemic and that are fighting in different parts of the world against this system. This is happening as we talk. This is not something I'm inventing in my head. Okay? This is happening as we talk. Okay? This is a process that is ongoing. And it's happening in many parts of the world today. And if you examine carefully, 40 years ago, all these third world movements were Marxist. Today, they're all radical political Islamic Shia movements, Hezbollah, or you have in Bolivia the Aymaras, or you have the Zapatista Tojolabales, or you have political Buddhism in Malaysia and in Thailand, or you have, all of them are saying, you know what? Eurocentrism is in terminal crisis of the right and the left. So they are going back to the toolbox of their old ancient knowledges, open the box again, that we were told that box was traditional, was backward, was primitive, and now they're looking back and say, well, wait a minute, let me look back because this is not working. And now all these movements are thinking from different epistemologies. The system can swallow off identities but not epistemologies. This is the point. This alternative epistemology cannot be swallowed up. Okay? They cannot be swallowed up. They can swallow up colonial versions of those epistemologies, like Wahhabism. We discussed that yesterday. Wahhabism is a Protestant colonization of Islam. That's Protestantism inside Islam, called Islam. That's Wahhabism. Okay? And the same thing with other versions. You could see there are colonial versions within that world. I'm talking about the critical, radical thinking in different traditions, you see, that are thinking in terms... Let's reverse the thing again. When I'm talking about pluriverse of meanings, okay, I'm not saying everything goes. Okay, I'm not saying everything goes. Because I'm talking about a form of universalism that is different from the West. And so I'm not saying in pluriversalism everything goes in the relativist way. Now, how do I enter in inter-epistemic dialogue with traditions of thought that are critical that I don't know? Let's say I don't know the Aymara world. How do I decide about that? What criteria? Well, I believe we should have a negative universality, not a positive one. That is, we are anti-imperialist, we're anti-colonial, we're anti-capitalist, we're anti-patriarchal. That negative universality, allows me to know that if I go to that Mara world, I will enter in dialogue with Evo Morales and not with Cárdenas. You see? If I go to the Islamic world, I prefer to talk to Ali Shariati and not with Bin Laden. I prefer to talk with Islamic feminists and not with the Saudi kingdom.
I would prefer to go with both.
Okay. What I try to say is that, I don't know what you mean by what you just said, but what I'm trying to say is that I will try to use an anti, a universalism that is anti, is negative, than a positive one. Now, we enter in conversation now, let's say, in inter-epistemic dialogues. What we cannot have now is a positive universalism, that is, I Islamic or I Western or I Aymara now coming and saying, you know, the solution is this. Because the moment I come up with this, then one again defines for the rest. And we go back again to the Western imperial universalism, where one defines for everybody. And what we need to have there, that's when you need then the pluriverse. That you have to understand that the way people will fight back patriarchy or imperialism or colonialism or capitalism, different parts of the world, is going to be different. The institutional framework and even the epistemic critiques are going to be different. You cannot pretend that the anti-systemic critique will be the same, because that was 20th century socialism. That's exactly what 20th century, the Marxist-Leninist project was about. It was a Eurocentrism from the left that ended up being imperialist and colonialist. Because it was reproducing once again the question that, oh, the solution is, with the capital S, the dictatorship of the proletariat. It was supposed to be everywhere like that. And if you don't like it in certain places within their sphere of influence, they will send the troops. Okay? So, the point I'm trying to say is, there are things that can be swallowed up from identity understood in a more superficial way, but there are profound things in those identities, you see. And the critical thinking produced from that diverse epistemic world, that's the system that not swallow that up, you see. Now, if the movement made mistakes, that's another story, you see. But the Zapatista failed not because they were swallowed up by the system, but they made mistakes that were have consequences, you see. The same thing with other movements. But if you look profoundly at the Zapatista revolution, they are doing an epistemic revolution in many ways. And that haven't been swallowed up by the system. The system in Mexico haven't been able to swallow up their proposals. Just take, for example, the idea of walking while asking. The system cannot swallow that up.
Andrés Manuel is doing that.
I'm sorry?
Andrés Manuel López Obrador is also doing that. One of the possible candidates for the next election in 2012. And he would be part, eventually, of the party system. We could say that he's following that. He's bringing into the party system a principle that is coming from the top of the idea.
That could happen, yes. But the problem is, the moment someone like him do that, then it becomes a radical project. Then he will find difficulties in being elected. Then the U.S. will react. Wait and see. How far he go with the idea, I don't know. You know, he can superficially adopt it, superficially make it seem it's this way, when in fact it's commanding while preaching. You know, walking while preaching. You see. Maybe he's doing that. I don't know. Maybe he's formally saying this and not doing it in reality. But if he's doing it seriously, that would be a major thing in terms of a major revolution in Mexico. And I don't know how far he will go with that, you see, in terms of the political battles, you see, that entail. You see the point? Now, the Zapatistas are the first one to say, this knowledge is for everybody. This is not for us indigenous. They say, no, this is for everybody. You want to do politics and you do it this way, fine, take it, you know, appropriate it, do it, but do it seriously. Now we need to see if Andrés Manuel is going to do it seriously. You see, that needs to be seen, how far he goes. I don't know.
You know,
but if he goes seriously deep into that, that's not, he won't become part of the system appropriating this. He will become a fear, anti-systemic fear, because this idea is too powerful to, for the system to swallow. It's too much for the system to swallow. To allow these inter-epistemic dialogues, you see, to redefine democracy in pluriversal ways and things like that, that's too much for the system. That will entail a major, major transformation for the system to swallow that.
Okay, I think Sabina wants to finish your question.
Two other things, but I better go later.
Because we have Anne, Arturo, and...
But please, let me do this again.
Anne was
your
answer.
Okay, I want to make a commentary regarding your lecture and also Dussel's lecture of philosophy, because you made a very important distinction between the subject of enunciation and the subject of the statement. Right?
No, like, not the subject of the statement. The statement, what is being said.
Okay, then this is another thing, because Jacques Lacan, the psychologist, makes a distinction between the subject of enunciation, the one who is speaking, and the subject or the content of what is said. And I find this distinction very, very important when one reads philosophy, because it's not the same what you're saying with philosophy regarding the content, and how you use that content. And what I try to say is, I don't see in Descartes, for example, and necessarily reading of such universalism the way you're speaking about. And I will say why. For example, you can always read a philosopher against himself. And if you read Descartes carefully, he's not saying that he stayed in place of God. He's saying that I think, therefore I am. And why is this thinking? Not thinking this or that, just because I cannot know anything, I cannot be sure about anything, I doubt, and that's despair. And despair is the proof that I am, and I am that despair. And who can save me? Only God. And what's the second part of the argument? Infinity. That is, I have the idea of infinity, and because I am a terrestrial being and finite, I could not have found or made up the idea of the infinite in myself, and that means that God put it in me. So, because God is in me and I recognize that something different from me is in me, then I believe in a God, and I trust this God. So, if I trust this God, then this God is not going to lie to me, and then I can trust also my senses and I can reconstruct knowledge. So, this is just to say that there are some elements already in the philosophy of Descartes to read or to interpret the subject as situated. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, the concept of ideology, and that's what I brought Lacan to the discussion, it's not the same. To say, for example, it's very hot here because I feel it, or to say because I want to do something, for example, open the window. So there are some uses philosophy cannot be in itself from the right or from the left or directly oppressive or liberating, because there are always uses of philosophy. So you can perfectly, yes, as you have said, you can perfectly use the discourse of the left to be actually a reactionary. And you can also take arguments from the right, not in the way the right is using them, but to negate them, and this way I'm very Hegelian and Marxist, to make a determinate negation. And I think it's very important in philosophy not to judge very in general and to make such a package, but always to be very precise in which point the argument of some philosopher implies a political statement. For example, in the case of Kant, Yes, of course. In the writings about anthropology, he's saying that the model of the rational subject is white, it's male, etc. But there are also, if you read the critic of pure reason, then he's not saying, and he cannot say who is that subject. And in principle, that subject is everyone. And that idea, taking only from the critic of pure reason, can be used in Latin America, for example, for a fight of independence, or this idea of independence in general, and the idea that the subject doesn't need any type of tutoring. So, being a subject in the Enlightenment way of understanding the point doesn't mean that I take necessarily the place of God, so, but that I don't need a God to say what I want to say, but that I rely directly on my reason. So, if you take that argument, then you can use it against Kant, and you can use that argument also against Descartes, and you don't have to throw all the philosophy to the trash. Because, for example, I think to myself, when I receive this education in the university, when I go to study, as you say, philosophy, Mexico. Then, in that very moment, for my education and place I live, this tradition becomes part of me in some way. So, I like very much the idea of Bolívar Echeverría, for example, who says, well, it's right, actually the mestizaje, what is crossing you, and it's what is actually making you fall apart into different traditions. Because I could not say like a Mexican part that is stronger than my, let's say, European way of thinking. What actually is very interesting in the concept of the mestizo is that you don't have just one route. Your roots go in all directions, and you're just like the knob or the point of an intersection, and I think he used the idea of intersection. And the idea of intersection is way more interesting than being inside or outside, because then you start thinking in terms of nets and in terms of networks, and not anymore in terms of dualisms, because this is a dualism, and to some extent it indebted to the dualism of Descartes.
So which geopolis of knowledge you are saying this?
Well, that's,
where are you thinking from?
Well, that's exactly the point. That's exactly what I wanted to arrive to, because I wouldn't say I cannot say my place of initiation. I can tell you I'm a Mexican, I can tell you I have some political interest of the left, I can tell you I
okay, are you indigenous Mexican? Are you black Mexican? Are you mestizo Mexican? You're a white Mexican? Where are you located in your...
I'm not white. Huh? I'm not white.
Okay. So you're a mestizo Mexican?
No.
No, I'm asking that from where are you thinking. I will tell you why. Because in what you're saying...
No, but what I'm saying, just my existence, just being in Mexico and having lived there and having experienced Mexican and European and North American or whatever, makes me not a place of things, not doesn't oblige me to speak from an already existing place. What I'm trying to say is, I'm a singular place of initiation, and I don't have to say if I belong to the system or to the outside of the system, or if I have to say, well, I am Mexican, mestizo, and that will entitle me to have more or less reason than any other. I just cannot say, and my feeling is that I am crossed by many traditions, and from which I could not say this is more important than this one, and just the mestizaje, of these encounters, many of them just because of chance, and I don't feel compelled to say my place of enunciation, because I am producing with my language and while I'm thinking the very place of my enunciation instead of occupying it. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me go part by part in your statement. The first one about you could deconstruct anybody. Okay? You could use a deconstruction and put an author to say something opposed to what the author is saying with anybody. That's deconstruction. But the limits of deconstruction is that it's a kind of Eurocentric, because you are installing the same authors that are becoming canonic in the power relations of the world, okay, as the authors that now keep being the authorities of knowledge production. And so you could take and live your life deconstructing the car, deconstructing Foucault, deconstructing everybody, okay, and never arrive to epistemic diversity. Never arrive the time to read anybody else except this tradition of thought. Okay, one. Second, in the card, if you watch carefully, the card has an ambiguity there that has to do with his time. He was trying to save his life. Okay, he was very, very concerned that he might be burned. That's very clear in his letters. And, you know, he was afraid for the thing he was saying. That's why he brings God back, okay, to try to get some kind of, let's say, authority, okay, in which he can escape any attack from the Inquisition. At the moment, he was really afraid of his life, literally afraid of his life. So the reading of the card, if you read carefully the card, his move is toward a scientific project, away from the church and from theology. He ends up bringing God in as a way to evade the possibility of being accused of blasphemy in the eyes. That's very clear in his letters, where he is very afraid of this happening. So he moved into theology as a way to avoid the consequences of the thing he's saying with regard with the "I think, therefore I am." So the point is that if you examine carefully his claim, strong claim, and that's the way in the legacy of the West he has been appropriated. It's not so much where he ended up bringing God at some point at the end, but it's more the part where he is calling for the production of a God-eye view, for the "I think, therefore I am," for a new foundation that will open up the possibility of doing sciences away from the authority of the church. That's where the Cartesian move, okay, becomes. Now, if you want to, let's say, deconstruct the car, of course, you could do that with the car, with anybody. Now, the point is, what is the legacy of the car? Okay, what is the project of the car, and what is the legacy of the car? This is the question, you see. So I'm not so much concerned by doing a deconstruction of the car. Of course we could do that and find a different Descartes there, you know. We could do that with anybody. The point is, what is the prevalent project in an author, no? And what, from where this author is producing knowledge in the geopolitics of knowledge of the world, what are the consequences? And from which body politics of knowledge that knowledge is being produced? This is the question. And if you examine carefully what is the role of Cartesianism and Descartes, the work of Descartes and its legacy in the West, I was focusing fundamentally on the universal question. I was not focusing on other aspects of the work of Descartes, or Kant, or Hegel, or Marx. There are many aspects. You could go into the ethics, you could go into the aesthetics, you could go into all kinds of areas that, you know, that would be a different lecture, okay? I was focusing on what kind of concept of universalism is emerging out of this tradition of thought. This is what I was doing, okay? And so that's why I left out many other aspects, okay? Now, you could do work of decolonizing Descartes, decolonizing Kant, decolonizing Hegel, decolonizing Marx, okay? That work can be done. Okay, you could do that. It's no problem doing that. Okay, you could try to make the card, try to find ways, okay, of decolonizing the card and try to find ways to see how it can work for a decolonial project. I'm open to that. I'm not close to that, you see? But you will have to decolonize the author, because the author never thought the realities of a process of colonial condition. They never thought of that. So you will have to decolonize them. You will have to do twist to their arguments to bring them to a different reality, you see, because they never thought of that, okay? That's one. Second, the second thing is that you need to be careful with the question of mestizaje. Okay, of mestizaje, I don't know how to translate that in, you know what, everybody knows what we're talking about, the mixture of cultures and things like that. Why I'm saying that? Because your statement sounds celebratory of mestizaje, you know, and I have reserve with that. Why? First of all, there's no culture or no epistemology that is not the result of mestizaje. Every culture, every epistemology in the world, be that non-Western, Western, you name it. We were mentioning how the Greeks were a crossover of Phoenician, Egyptian, Persian. We could say the same of the Tohola Valley. There are like 7 ethnicities there in Chiapas, and the Zapatistas is a crossover of the Tohola Valley. Has all these other influences there. You know, it's a crossover of. So in a sense, the creolization of culture or the mixture of cultures, that's everywhere. You know, there's no pure culture in that sense. Okay, now. If we take this argument as an argument from where to then look at this system, the problem, there are two problems with this. The first problem is that it's kind of, it becomes trivial. It becomes trivial because mixture of cultures and epistemology becomes everywhere. There's nothing pure in that sense. I will depart from that premise. And therefore, so where are we at? We are in some kind of anthropological argument that is not telling me anything about the power structure we live and what are the consequences of these kind of things. Second, in Latin America, mestizaje is an ideology, it's a racist ideology, okay? It's a racist ideology that has been used by the white Creoleites to inferiorize non-Western people inside Latin America, okay? So beware with the identity of mestizo and the celebration of mestizaje, because it has been used historically to privilege the West over the rest. Because in fact, the mestizaje, it happened that it's not exactly equal, everybody there, okay? The Indian in Mexico is put as a, in a painting, and it's a romantic view of the Indian of the past. The epistemology of the Indian today is not there in that mestizaje. It's completely erased, invisibilized, and inferiorized. So that mestizaje is a Eurocentric ideology that has been used to inferiorize blacks, indigenous people all over the Americas. And part of the ideology presided of the state to hide its white Creole character is to say, oh no, no, we are Mexicans. And Mexicanness is mestizaje. Okay? We are a mestizo like Vasconcelos, no? The ideology of mestizaje. We are composed of all these cultures, all these races, all these things, okay? And when you examine carefully, the Indian they celebrate is an Indian of 500 years ago, not the Indian of today, you see? The black they celebrate is the black of 200 years ago, not the black of today. Not how blacks and indigenous people are thinking about Mexico today. And so in the name of mestizaje, then you go and study Hegel, and study Kant, and study Descartes, and study the others. Where do you study the thinking, the critical thinking of Mexican indigenous people in the name? Tell me one single program. So beware with the ideology of mestizaje. That's the quintessential ideology of racism used in Latin America for the last 200 years. And it's being used by white tribal elites to create precisely the ideology that we're somewhere mestizos, it's nice, we celebrate, we have all these different traditions. I cannot place myself anywhere, you know, because we are, you know, so.
I'm not saying that, and precisely what I'm saying doesn't doesn't matter the discourse in itself. It's not your center God or not your center God. You can, I think, in Bolivar Echeverria work in a very consistent way to give an idea of the mestizaje in a non-colonial, precisely in a decolonizing perspective. That's exactly the point. You cannot judge so fast discourses and thoughts and to say that it belongs to the right or to the left or it belongs to the system or the exterior of the system, because in that very diagram you're showing that they are all mixed. And
let's talk, instead of talking abstractly like you're talking now, tell me what is a definition of mestizaje that is decolonial. Show me that. Tell me what is Bolivar Echeverria definition that you're saying, because you said that here, but you never define it. Tell me what is that. I'm telling you, there's no definition of mestizaje in Latin America that is not racist. Look what I'm saying. That the moment you take the mestizaje line, that's the ideology of the white Creole elites to precisely make us believe that we are a mixture of all these cultures, when in fact in reality we are privileging white Creole elites and throwing down indigenous people and black people.
I take your definition of mestizaje, it's just
a mixture. If it's just a mixture, then a mixture is every culture. Yes, it's irrelevant.
There's a big difference between assuming that mixture and forgetting that mixture, because part of your critique of your central thought is that they forgot, but they try to cover that mix. And it's very important in a thought of the mestizaje not to say just the way we all come from different traditions and that's how the world is. It's not the point, that's not my point. But to assume it, and that's very different because you're starting from the point of being the intersection and not necessarily an already place. Because what I fear is that in the moment in which you say I am this and that, or I am speaking from this and that point, then you close yourself to one place. Look, what I'm trying to distinguish is not the same, the groups actually existing and the discourse and thought. For example, when I'm speaking, I recognize the groups, I recognize indigenous people, I recognize black women, I recognize Mexico, Latin America, I recognize real and concrete groups. But when you're speaking and when you're thinking, you cannot restrain yourself and say, this is a Mexican, just Mexican thought. That's all I said.
I never said that this is Mexican. I don't use national identities as ways of attributing thought. Okay? I don't use national identities because I find it problematic. Because there are Euro-Mexican, there are Black Mexican, there are Indigenous Mexican. So to say Mexican for me is meaningless. You see? To say Latin American for me is meaningless too. Okay? So beware of this definition because I haven't used that. I don't know why you're attributing me to use those terms. I am very suspicious of using terms like that. That's why I call you. Where are you thinking from? Are you thinking as a mestizo? Are you thinking as a Euro-Mexican? As a black Mexican? As an indigenous Mexican? Where are you thinking? Don't tell me you're Mexican, because that's not you. You were the one who used that identity. And I ask you, where are you thinking from precisely because of that? Because Mexican is meaningless. There are so many Mexicans. It's a heterogeneous experience. And therefore, from which of the Mexican stories or history you're thinking from? That's my question. Because if you're thinking from mestizaje, then you're thinking from a particular position of privilege in the Americas that has always been a discourse to hide and conceal the subalternized groups in those places. Now, the point here is the following. We always have to talk about these questions in terms of the power relations of the regions we are. In Europe, the attempt at erasing the mixture and call for purity is a form of the colonial power here that has been attempted at being extrapolated to other parts of the world, okay? As well as the Anglo-American world in North America. But in Latin America, the way colonial power works is not through discourses of purity. In Latin America, white Creole elites work through discourses of mestizaje and mixture. You see, the way it works to establish the white supremacy in Brazil, in Colombia, in Mexico, everywhere in the Americas is through these courses of mestizaje, racial democracy, and things like this. Okay, that are very different from this course of purity that have been mobilized mostly in places like Europe and even North America. Okay, so you need to understand how power structures are and racial ethnic hierarchies have been conceived in different parts of the world. Okay, because for example, in places like Latin America, the colonial project could not come up with a discourse of purity. It didn't work there for a very simple reason, because demographically the majorities were non-whites, were indigenous people and blacks. So you have to come up with a way to create identities in which you bring them, mestizaje means and close to white. This is what mestizaje means. It's a way of making indigenous people and black people think they are closer to whiteness, closer to the West, than to indigenous or black. And so they create a strata of people from below, that's talking about hegemony, from below with identities that distance themselves from blackness and indigeneity, making them believe they are closer to whiteness. This is the mestizaje ideology. And it's used by the white colonial elites to create hegemony in contexts where they are a demographic minority. How do you rule a place where the majority of people are non-whites? Well, you make them believe they're closer to white by creating an ideology of mestizaje. In North America, like the United States, that doesn't work. Why? Because the white colonial elites, the ones who were running North America, did not have the need to create there's no mestizaje in North America. There's no mulatto in North America. There's no mestizo in North America because the demographic majority were whites. And therefore, demographic minority were blacks and indigenous people. They had no need to create a strata, you see, from below, with mestizaje ideology or mulatto ideology to create, you know, that to do hegemonic politics, you see? Because the overwhelming majority were demographically white. The same thing in Australia, you see? So the colonial power works in different ways in different places, and you need to account for this. And my call is be very careful of the use of mestizaje ideology, because that's exactly the quintessential ideology used by white colonialists in the Americas to racialize, inferiorize people. Okay, that's the way white supremacy operates in the Americas. That's my call. It's very different from North America and Europe.
But we'll go with other questions. Sorry. No, but we will go to dinner afterwards. We can continue. I have in the list you.
Well, I don't want to change the topic. No, I'm not strong. I have one question. You criticized Obama and Spivak in one of your lectures a little at least. So I would like to know how you reflect the contradiction of your own position inside the Western science. Inside Western science. You are coming here from Western University. Other question would be, what I find difficult is the idea of a system that you create. Because I think colonialism was already a total globalized phenomenon, you know? Like, I mean, the Spanish people, they came with a bunch of guys who colonized the whole Aztec Empire. Like, they used the structure of the Aztec Empire, which was much more stronger than they were in reality, but they used it, you know. So it was like a totally independent, not independent, it was a total dependence between. Like, the system idea that you create, I would argue, is totally in itself Eurocentric, you know, because the world cannot be understood like there was this system which came over the others. I would argue it was all entangled, you know? And of course, there are most victims and some little winners. Racism, all of this was produced without any doubt. I agree with you in all of this. But I mean, there are some critics in post-colonial theory, like Ahmad, I think, and Santuan from Philippines, and they are arguing that post-colonial, or may call it decolonial theories, are also kind of inside Western logic, you know? Like, producing its own critique, but without any power to change, you know? What happened with this?
Okay, so in terms of the history, First of all, the system I'm calling here, which I call a civilization, you were here yesterday.
I prefer
to call it a civilization. It was not created here and then going there. It was created as part of the expansion to the Americas. That is, it's the colonial project that creates this global system, global civilization. It didn't exist before. No, it didn't exist before. It exists exactly the moment they expand to the Americas and create a world market and create the global structures of power that I mentioned yesterday, okay? So it's in this interaction that it happened. There was no Europe identity at the time. I don't know if you're aware that in the 16th century nobody called themselves European.
Yeah.
These are concepts that are created and categories and identities that are created as part of this interaction with the colonial world. Okay? It's a relational thing. They call them over there the Indias Occidental, Western West Indies. That was the name they first used to name that part of the world. And then that was when it fit back into the question of calling themselves Western. You know, the Western thing came later. You see, so this is a mutually relation. Second thing, beware of anachronism. That is, pushing into the past the same structures of today. In 1491, there was a diversity of systems of political authority, economic systems, systems of living, systems of gender and sexual relations. I mean, there was a diversity in the world in 1491. There were many, many systems. To call an empire, the Aztec as an empire, is a kind of a symbolic violence, because we are projecting into the others. You see, the logics of the empires that we know in the West, in this case the Roman Empire, the word empire is already formulated from within the West. If you examine carefully, China is a lineage. If you examine the Ottomans, it was a sultanate. If you examine, if you look around the world, these are different logics. I'm not romanticizing the past. There were places, terrible places, where domination, exploitation, and everything you wanted, you know? What I'm saying is that something new of this system is the question of the human. That is, the inferiorization of groups of people that did not exist before. There were wars, there were conflict, there was domination, there was a protein, there was a form of colonialism, but there were colonialism without coloniality. What exists after 1492 is colonialism with coloniality. What do I mean by that? I mean with the racial ethnic hierarchy, with the line of the human defining, you know, who is here, how you assign in the division of labor, who does what, how much they earn, how much they get for what they do, is defined along the line of the human. And so this is new. This is a modern thing. And this is different from the Aztec Empire. This is different from, you know, we're using empire just for descriptive way. But in fact, how much you know about the Aztecs and their political authority system? You see, we're now saying it's an empire. Wait a minute.
Right.
We need to be careful in this. And then from Europe, history start projecting to the rest definitions that are from here. So I will accept to you to use the term, Aztec Empire or Ottoman Empire, or Chinese Empire, the day you call the Roman Empire a Roman lineage. You see? Or Roman Sultanate. Nobody says that, you see? Nobody says the Sultanate of Rome. You see the point?
No.
So it's a very Eurocentric idea to think that everything is an empire and everything is the same everywhere and the Europeans just did the same as everybody else. I'm sorry. The same thing happened with the debate of slavery today. Today there's a huge debate about slavery that is as if what happened after 1492 was the same as what had been happening before. And now we're blaming Muslims for being the origins of racial slavery. Well, wait a minute. I'm not defending slavery. I think slavery is terrible everywhere. You know, it doesn't matter. But there's something analytically here that we miss if we flatten down this in a way that we don't see the discontinuities here. During the Muslim civilization, there was slavery, but it was a completely different form of thinking about slavery. First, because there were the people capturing war. Okay? They were not people that were assigned to do something because of the color of their skin or because they were below the human. They were people that were capturing war, non-Muslims, and put to work, etc. Okay? That's one thing. So you have all colors there. You have all a lot of people there. There was, you know, there were not just blacks, you see, which is what happened with racial slavery after 1492. It became a racial thing. Second, there were, in the Muslim Empire, there were people who became sultans who were born as slaves. How do you explain that? That never could happen in racial slavery, because in racial slavery, it was impossible for people to stop being a slave. There were rights and things in the Muslim world that allowed for a slave to become a non-slave and move on. You know, so there are things that, you know, so it's, I'm not saying celebrating slavery, don't get me wrong, I'm just saying there is a tendency in the West to always think about everything that happened today and push it into Adam and Eve, into the past, and make it eternal. And we need to make analytical distinctions in terms of the shift in these processes. That is not the same, as I was saying, it's not the same wage labor in Boeing Company in Seattle, is not the same as wage labor in a maquiladora. These are two different, you know, types of labor, even though they're formally wage labor. The same thing happened with the question of slavery. It's not the same thing to talk about slavery after 1492, racial slavery, than slavery in the Roman Empire, or slavery in the Muslim world, or slavery. These are different animals altogether, because they belong to a different logic of domination, oppression, exploitation. And we need to account for that. We cannot take our categories of the present and push it into the past, you see, and make it eternal. You see? And the same thing happened with the question of empire. We need to be careful about the use of empire, and then we imagine the Muslim world coming and saying, oh, the Sultanate of Rome, the French Sultanate, the English Sultanate, and call Sultanate everything else. You see? Well, that's exactly what we do with the word empire. We call empire everything else. And wait a minute, these are not the same things. We need to analytically understand what is going on here, okay? And then about myself, situate myself, well, listen, I am a Puerto Rican in the U.S. In the U.S., to be Puerto Rican is to be an inferior colonial subject in that context, okay? I'm not in the white American university just because the whites gave up some position to minorities. My department was created through a strike in 1969 of people of color, indigenous people, black people, Asian people, Latino people. That department was created through a strike, 1969. 30 years later, 1999, there was another strike, because after 30 years, every professor that retired, they did not replace the position. And so they were shortening to make it disappear. There was another strike in 99. And so we gained 12 new positions. Okay? Now there is a hunger strike in the last month, because they're cutting off and throwing away 8 people from the staff of the department. So we're there through struggle. We conquered the space, okay? We're not there out of privilege. We're there because we conquered the space through struggle, and we continue to struggle, because they're finding ways to destroy our department. Our department is producing decolonial knowledge, and our aim is to decolonize the social sciences. That's why they hate us, because the kind of knowledge we produce there is completely against the grain inside Berkeley, inside one of the top universities of the world, you see? So that's how I'm there, okay? I'm there because of the struggle, okay? That's why I'm there. That I deserve to be there? Yes, I deserve to be there. Everybody in my department deserves to be there, but white universities did not allow us to enter. And that happened in Europe today. That happened in Germany. That happened in France. That happened everywhere in Europe today. When I look at European universities today, what I see is 1950s USA. White males running the show. People of color from Europe, born and raised here, completely out, with PhDs, publishing books and everything, out of the system. I see that in France, I see that in Germany, I see that in Britain, I see that everywhere. In the U.S., we have spaces there because we conquered it. It was nothing else, okay? We fought for it.
But don't you think this can already be a part of the Western or of the U.S. logic? That there is some little space that can be conquered, but nothing changed at the top, you know?
Well, that's why precisely they fight against that, because it's not that nothing changed. It's that the moment you start producing knowledge in a center like Humboldt Institute or Berkeley University, it has consequences over the politics and over all kinds of issues inside the society. It's not something like, oh, nothing changed. Many things change. You see, now minorities are in power. And that they produce their own autonomous critical knowledge away from the white Eurocentric knowledge. I'm critical of that, you see? And that's how I am in Berkeley. This is the history, okay? And we are still fighting. So, you know, and the fight continues. I wish and I hope that happened here in Europe, you know? And that something like that happened where people can conquer spaces. Look, in Amsterdam, the Black Dutch movement, of which I have contact with, they went and did riots and managed to conquer and produce an institute that is called Institute for... There is a student that was here the first few days who went to the Black Europe Summer School. What's her name? She's from Berlin. What's her name? She was here the first 2 days, your friend, sitting with you in the dinner that first night. What's her name? She was there. She knows about this. So, la que estaba sentada al lado tuyo en la cena el primer día, justo... La que estaba sentada en la esquina el primer día. No. Bueno, she's been in the Black Little Summer School. She's from Berlin. She can tell you about it. They did riots, and guess what? The Dutch university didn't want them inside the university. So they conquered space, but outside the university spaces. So they created an institute called Institute for the Study of Dutch Slavery and Its Legacies. Okay, and so they have a research institute studying the situation condition of Black Dutch and the history of Black Dutch inside Amsterdam today. Okay, but they have to do it outside the university because the university didn't accept them. They get funds from the state to even have a position of a Black intellectual, paid by the state, okay, to be lecturing in the university, and the university say no, it costs nothing to the university, but they prefer to not have it, you see, than to have it for free, you see. That tells you something about epistemic racism, okay. But they managed to conquer space. At least they have a space now, and they're producing knowledge, and this thing and its legacies brings the thing into the present, you see. It brings the thing into the present in such a powerful way that now they're dealing with questions about Dutch racism. You see? And they're producing their own institution, their own knowledge, their own critical knowledge, and this has an effect. This is it's that's why they fight against this kind of thing. That's why they look to destroy these things, because it has consequences. It's not like nothing changed. Many things change out of this, okay? So people from here, the tendency of many white left people is to look at the U.S. some kind of politically correct place. This is the word used, like, oh, these people are politically correct. I'm sorry, but there are things that is not about political correctness. It's about decolonizing spaces that now from here, people look at it with anxiety, and the way to expel it is to basically laugh at it, you know, and look and make a mockery of it and say, oh, this is politically correctness thing. Look at what happened to this guy. What's his name? The candidate of France. Troscan. Look at what happened to this guy. Well, this is endemic among the political elites of France and also academics, males, who abuse of women in all spaces you can imagine. But this silent in France. No consequences, you see? At least in the U.S. we conquer laws that might sound politically correct or absurd to many of these white males, but have consequences. They cannot go now and abuse of women the way they do here, with no consequences, okay? This was conquered by us, by the civil rights movement. This was not conquered by white establishment bringing liberty and freedom to women. I'm sorry. Okay? It was conquered by the civil rights movement. Okay? And the civil rights movement was not only blacks, it was Latinos, it was Asian people, it was women, it was, you know, and that has consequences. You see, this guy thought he was doing business as usual in the U.S. I'm sorry, you are in a different space, and that's a conquer of us, not of the white elites of the U.S. That's something we conquer. You see? So it has consequences. Now, this guy can do whatever in France and will go away with murder, you know, and that's the political elites in France. You can imagine the kind of thing that, you know, in the university spaces, terrible. You know, the kind of thing they do. And then they laugh at the U.S. You see, they say, oh, this political correctness, you know, this, they laugh, you know, because they can do all kinds of atrocities to women in public spaces with no consequences, with impunity. Well, this is a conquer that we got out of this struggle. And it might seem superficial to you, but it's not, you know, it's very
talking about civil rights will bring you to the question of Marxism. You know, you were quite critical with Marxism, but I would argue that Marxism was so strong in many aspects. If you look at the decolonization of Africa, for example, and up to Latin America, and because of this revolutionary moment, and I think civil rights movement in the States, they took a lot of profit out of it, you know.
Yeah, listen, I'm not saying there's nothing good about Marx or Hegel, Kant or anything, okay? I'm not saying that. I'm saying we need to, if you want to use Marx, you need to decolonize Marx, okay? Because Marx is very colonial, Eurocentric, and racist. So you need to decolonize Marx from Marx, okay? So I think there are many things interesting of Marx. I'm not anti-Marxist. I'm just presenting you a conference about the universalism of the West, and I wanted to bring Marx to show that this is not a right-wing thing, because many people take the critique to universalism of the West as a critique to the imperial eye. But the universalism of the West is reproduced by the other critical of that imperial eye within the zone of being. And that's Marx. And that's why I use Marx. You see, but I could have used Western feminists. And we have come with the same critique. Does that mean that Western feminists have nothing to contribute to the critique of sexism? No. I'm just saying this is a very Eurocentric way of thinking of universalism that traps them into all kinds of conflicts, like dismissing other forms of feminism as non-feminist. You see, this is the point I'm trying to say. Now, because I've been critical of this, doesn't mean I'm saying nothing useful from this. No, I'm not saying that. I'm going to participate in a conference this weekend on Marx. I think there are many things of Marx that are very useful. You need to read Marx to go over the critique of the capitalism. You see? That's very important and useful. I don't dismiss it. We have read it. You see? We have read it thoroughly. You guys haven't read us so thoroughly. We have read it. I said before that from the zone of non-being, we have read all of you guys, you know. But you, the people in the zone of non-being, critical of inside there, they haven't read the other thing, you see. But we have read Marx. If you watch my presentation, there is a lot of Marx there. In my critique of political economy and things like that, there's a lot of Marx. I'm not going to throw away Marx, you know. But we need to be very careful, because then we need a decolonial Marx, or we need to also read Eric Williams, you see, the political economy of Eric Williams. We need to read also the political economy of Oliver Cox, black thinkers in the Caribbean. We need to read other political economies, not just Marx. Marx got very limited. Now we need to read other people who have taken this further and look at it from the point of view of a black slave in the Caribbean. Then what kind of vision you have of capitalism when you do that? Then capitalism is not just capitalism, it's a racial system. It's a racial system from the beginning. You cannot think of capitalism as if it was deracialized, the way Marx does, because he thought of it from the European proletariat. But if you think about the same system from the other side of the coin, then you don't see just economics, you see also race, or gender, or Christianocentrism, or you see a package of power relations, you see, you were here yesterday, no? You see all the package that it was, it's invisibilized. So please don't read me as an anti-European fundamentalist. I'm not an anti-European fundamentalist. I have to repeat over and over again, because when you criticize Eurocentrism, the Eurocentric fundamentalism is such a common sense that when you do the critique, then immediately the reaction is as if I am anti-European, or I'm not recognizing anything good about Europeans. I'm sorry, that's not what I'm saying. Okay, I'm calling for inter-epistemic dialogues. That means that Europeans could be there, but they cannot be there like they were so far, defining the terms of the conversation for everybody. They have to come up with humility to the conversation as one more. And they have to listen. They cannot come up to preach. They have also to listen. You see, this is what I'm calling for, okay? So don't get me wrong when I do these critiques, please. I'm not Bin Laden, okay? I'm not Bin Laden.
Okay, I'm
so
sorry, but do we still have
time for
questions?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I wanted to ask a question about the intra-epistemic dialogue, and I really want to start about those. And I think that you were a wonderful lecturer, and that was really interesting and inspiring. And I have a lot to think about, and I will take a lot from it. And I guess I really appreciate the ways you talked about you criticized the solipsism, Western, traditions of thought. And I guess in a way, what I would like to ask about maybe it connects a little more on the epistemological level, but to the concern that was raised about epistemic formations or other ways of thinking being incorporated and internalized within this Western metaphysics or Western solipsism. And I guess I don't know, to position myself first, and then I guess in my academic work, most of what I try to do is I come from from the zone of being and the critical tradition in the zone of being, and I'm very interested in that as well. And what I try to do is have these dialogues and open these critical traditions up to and perspective from the zone of non-being, these critical traditions, right? And I'm always really grateful, and that's what I'm also want to take, that's what I'm so profoundly inspired about what you talked about perspectives that insist on an outside of ourselves being possible and showing ways out of them, because maybe that's my academic deconstructive upbringing, but sometimes it seems to me that really all I ever think and all I ever read academically turns out to be this variation of the same. And that's what I that's where I want to get to, is that I'm really worried about the ways in which these different discourses enter my academic discourse that is so Eurocentric, and then I try to criticize it by incorporating different ideas. And I don't know, for example, I think I read a course in an article of Fernando Coronio, in which he talks about different geopolitical categories, how to develop them beyond Eurocentric fetishism. And one example of Eurocentric fetishism he talks about is this way of using non-Eurocentric or perspectives that lie beyond the Eurocentric solipsism and incorporating them in order to destabilize your own categories. This is just one more form of variation of Eurocentric universalism, because you're just functionalizing these perspectives and in your own discourse. And you're not really destabilizing the foundations of your universal Western Eurocentric universalism, right? So I was wondering, I guess, I don't know, maybe it's unfair or a little, cheap and tend to ask you for the solution to this problem, but really this is something I've been struggling with for some time, and it seems to me that you have put such high hopes on the level of epistemology, and that you have a strong, it really shaped the foundation of epistemological and Eurocentrism. There's a lot to gain there, and I agree. And I was just wondering, like, what your thoughts of that are, and maybe when you answered a different question, you came up with this concept of negativity. And again, me coming from this very Eurocentric tradition, my first chain of association is Adorno and like critical like traditions that are Eurocentric. And maybe you could talk a little more about this idea of negativity, the negative like universalism, and maybe tell me about like sources that you're referring to that lie outside that Eurocentric canon. Yeah.
Yeah. The reason I'm coming here, having this conversation, is because I have hope. Okay, in the decolonial possibility of Europe, despite the negative news we read in the press every day. That is, I have hope that a movement for decolonizing Europe might emerge, and might emerge not just from the people who are oppressing Europe as colonial subjects, but also from white people in Europe that will embrace the project of decolonization. You know, and I can give you as an example the work of Boaventura de Sousa Santos, who is an example of a decolonial thinker inside Europe, because the ways of decolonization for someone who is in the zone of non-being, or someone who is an oppressed in the zone of being, are going to be different. It cannot be the same. But there is the path of decolonization is open for everybody. It's not that decolonization is for people in the zone of non-being and the people in the zone of being forget it. There's nothing to do about it. No. In the zone of being, I think there is a path of decolonization, but it's different. The difference is that in the zone of being, because you are in a privileged position, even as oppressed, okay, even as an oppressed, you are in a privileged position, you have to open up to the critiques coming from the other side of the fence, you see. And that's a decolonial move that is take seriously the critical thinking of, for example, indigenous feminists or black feminists, or you know, take seriously that thinking, you know, into questioning the way you're thinking about critics to patriarchy. Okay, take it seriously as a point of departure. Let's say in the feminist movement. Okay, if you're in another struggle, if you are in a gay lesbian struggle, take seriously the queer theory produced from the other side of the fence. Okay, read with attention, listen to that, and this is something that Enrique Dussel always repeats. To listen is not to translate the other into the same, because that would be a form of colonizing. You're listening, but then you're transforming the whole thing into your own categories and subsuming it into your own rationality. Listen the other as other. That means something different. That means to listen the other as other is to recognize that there's a different rationality, and that then you have to do an effort to understand and learn from that rationality that is different from yours. Okay? This is the decolonial move, if you want to call it. But this is a principle of the ethics of liberation in Dussel, which is always take the other, listen to the other, not as part of the same. You know, listen to the rationality of that other in itself, not trying to put it in your own categories and language, because then you miss the whole thing. You see? So this will be
only the problem, obviously, in a situation where my own position is so invested in these perspectives and these struggles in these Eurocentric categories. Like I come from a gender studies background in the whole, and it was actually evidently by feminism can be an excellent example for these other etymologies, and at the same time white feminism can be very good examples for universal, like Western universal. At the same time, in broad parts, it also can, because the move to position like away from objectivity and away from universalism to positions of standpoints, and I mean that is like
standpoint epistemology.
Is one, if you could argue that this is something that, well, Marxism also started in a very important way, but we would say that Heinrich Tobit further, because it was already like from the beginning of the second wave feminism, like the black feminism and like feminism from the global south was like so important. And So I guess the point I want to make is that this idea of like listening, of course, and having these dialogues, trying to have these dialogues, yes, and absolutely essential in trying to learn, but at the same time, I don't know, 30, 40 years later, we still have the same problems, like it's the dialogues, the positions in the dialogue that are not even to begin with. And then like moving within the calculus of academia, like that's a problem. I mean, I agree that it makes, and I get the point that coming, like having these spaces, these little pockets within academia, maybe gender studies, maybe the ethnic studies department, they come out of struggles, makes a huge difference, but at the same time, they still have to adhere to the logics of academia, right? And so the question how these radical ideas get incorporated, and maybe not neutralized, maybe that would be extinguishing the radical spark that is still there. But it seems like the dangers of being turned, there's a difference between entering an existing structure and building a new house, right? I mean, that's a,
There's no guarantees in that sense. When you enter these are political struggles, and there's no guarantees. You take risk. That's all you can do. Take risk, and you know, continue the struggle. The risk of being, you know, of being co-opted. There's a risk of being co-opted, which was what she was claiming before. There's a risk of being co-opted. There's a risk of power struggles. Incorporating something there to try to dismiss the struggle, things like this. This is always happening. But that doesn't mean we're, you know, that because of the risk, we're going to stop from mobilizing and try to do our best. You know, this is my only simple solution to that question, because I don't think there are any guarantees except continue the struggle, except try to find ways decolonizing the university. That's a project that I find very important. We need to decolonize the university. That means moving from university to pluriversity. That means different criteria of knowledge production, different criteria of thinking about discipline. We need to think transdisciplinary. That means different criteria in terms of evaluation of the work done, because then if you apply disciplinary knowledge in a mechanical way to gender studies, for example, you just chop down, you know, because then they will use criteria that is completely foreign to the knowledge production produced by the critical thinking or gender studies, you see? This is the kind of struggles that are ongoing and that will continue ongoing. The university, the way it is right now, is Western patriarchal university. And this structure is, you know, very much Western male oriented. And so that means that the struggle is, it's a struggle that will imply several fronts, okay? That is not just the racial front, it's also the gender front, it's the sexual front, many fronts there that have to be engaged, you know? And it's not going to be easy, it's not going to be immediate, it's a long-term struggle. But the point is that it has to be recognized as a form of it has to be recognized as our horizon of where we're going, you know, in terms of the struggles. That if we need to, if you are inside this institution, you're going to work inside universities, there is a space there for struggle. You have to become also a voice for the critical thinking that is not in this space. You have to encourage that those voices are heard here. You know, you have to be part of that struggle. If you have the privilege of being able to enter, then you have a responsibility and a commitment to make sure that in these spaces, those critical voices are listened here and are taken seriously as part of knowledge production. That's the difference between thinking with, thinking together, you know, and thinking about. The academia is expert in thinking about, you know, because it's always the other is an object of study. But thinking with, thinking together with, you know, is a different thing, because then you're now establishing a dialogue as equal and learning, you know. know, and learning the critical thinking produced in other spaces that are not represented in the university. You see, and so this is part of the decolonial methodology we need to encourage, you know, to move beyond this patriarchal westernized university. And I admit to you that it's not easy, that it's a long-term struggle, and that is, there's no guarantees. That's what I can say.
I had a question on human rights, but probably, I think you've, in the most part, you already answered the question when you said that there's not everything about Marx is so bad, and when you mentioned the civil rights movement or what you did in the 60s. Because I think in human rights there is still much of emancipatory potential. So how would you, what would you say to that, and to anticipate your to your answer, how to decolonize human rights?
Yeah. Again, the way it is right now, I already mentioned, is one defining for the rest, used as an imperial colonial global design, used in an instrumental way to, you know, for the interests of Western interventions elsewhere, you know, overlook wherever is an allied regime that is doing atrocities. When we look to the other side, you know, when it is a friend, we look to the other side. When it is an enemy, then we intervene, and we, you know what I mean? This is very hypocritical, the use of this concept. The other thing that is one defining for the now, how to decolonize is the same methodology that to apply to anything else, which is going beyond the universal definition and work over the production of a pluriversal definition of human rights. For example, there is an essay by Boaventura de Sousa Santos that is fantastic, because he does an exercise in this essay. What he goes into is Western ways of thinking of human rights, human dignity, Islamic ways of thinking of human rights, and Sanskrit ways in India of thinking of human rights, human dignity. And then he tries to establish a conversation about, okay, what is missing in one, and what can you gain from the other, you see? And then establish a kind of pluriversal concept of human right that will have things that are excluded from the Western definition, you see, or things in the other definition that do not have some good things of the Western definition, you see. But that's a different conversation, because now is, you know, the West enter as one interlocutor, you see, one more, not one that is defining for the rest. You see, the point is now, let's look at a diverse ways of thinking of human dignity, and let's see what are the absences, what are the strengths, and you know, this kind of exercise. He's doing it alone, which is very bad, because then you can make a lot of mistakes. You see, the best thing is to do it as a in dialogue with people who have thought about it in other traditions. That's the best way, you see, because then you have you can enter in dialogues with people who know their own tradition better than you, you know. But I find this exercise of Boaventura very useful, because it's a way of breaking up the concept of human rights away from the kidnapping of the concept by the West.
Okay, but why are you then defining human rights only in this matrix of hegemonial Eurocentric?
Why
are you defining human rights only in this within this Eurocentric hegemonial way? Because I think there is a potential emancipation in the human rights.
Yeah, but it is used only if you invested with epistemic diversity. Yes, it has potential as long as you bring in epistemic diversity to the definition and to the concept. The way it is right now is a definition that is short of addressing questions of human dignity in many parts of the world. One, and second, is a definition that is instrumentalized in a very convenient way, okay, by the West. So that's why I'm saying this is the way out of it is try to think of a definition of human rights that will be pluriversal rather than universal. And the way out of it in the long run will be to create a United Nations that, instead of having universal concept of human rights, will have pluriversal concept of human rights.
When I think of LGBT movement, or gays and lesbian in Central and Eastern Europe, or former communist countries, they are referring all the time to the human rights discourse. So, and I wouldn't say that they are colonized subjects.
Okay, the problem is that there are situations in the world today where the people who are in situations of oppression, like take the example that someone gave me before about Palestinians, for example, such a situation of oppression that sometimes there are places where sometimes you use some of the same institutions to fight back, you see? At the same time that the same actor, the same people doing it, they know the limits. They're not buying into the whole package. But they have tactically, in many spaces, to have to use this. You see? That's not ideal, because at the same time, these same definitions go against their own view of human rights. But they have to use it in certain contexts to fight back. That's it.
And also, if you contextualize what's going on with the arguments for, like, the basing LGBTQI, like, in men's claims on human rights, that is exactly right now we're seeing this, how these movements become part of an imperial project in the same way the argument for women's liberation has been part of the colonial project all along. And it's a really, I don't know, like, sorry, I'm really politically invested in this, I'm like, so yeah, it stresses me out. Like, seriously, this is what happens, and this is how the white position becomes totally normalized in these movements, and this is how certain subjects within, like, these identity categories gain access to power structures and to a normalized state identity in the West, and how they become part of arguing for military interventions in the, well, different other contexts that are constructed as backwards that they need enforcement of human rights. So the argument, the incorporation of LGBTQI liberation and the blending it with the human rights discourse, in my opinion, leads to it becoming an instrument of global imperial politics.
What you're saying about German context, and I was saying about Eastern Central Europe.
Actually, okay, so the relationship between Western and Eastern Europe and how solidarity... So I was talking actually about the U.S. context and Western European context, how... And I'm particularly familiar with the context, like, groups and movements in Great Britain and in Germany, and how they, like, white activists mobilize for intervention in the African context and in Arabic countries, and how they join forces with state perspectives with the argument that it's dangerous there and people conceding. And so that's a colonial trope, right? And I would say that actually the relationship between, like, the attempts to have solidarity structures between Western European and Eastern European activists is a little different because of the possibility to have, like, on the ground, like, solidarity work. Because, I don't know, like, I know people who actually work together in Berlin, there are groups who work together with groups in Poland, very different, like, countries, Eastern European countries, and the alliance work on the ground is much more possible, like, easier possible than for me as a Berlin activist to, I don't know, like, maintain solidarity structures. The groups in Uganda. I don't know, like, I don't have the possibility to meet up with them and go to demonstrations together or have a meeting together. I would say there is a difference, but I wouldn't say that the structure we just talked about on the discursive level of how one's national identity is constructed as imperial, like, more than the national identity of ethnic identity. I don't think that the difference is so big between Western Europe and Eastern Europe. I think there's, like, there are hierarchies as well. Okay, sorry, I did not. I actually shouldn't hijack the discussion. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, this is a good point in terms of, you look how, for example, Bush justified invasion of Afghanistan and Blair in the name of woman liberation. So suddenly these people who are reactionary patriarchal leaders in, for example, this guy, Bush is an Islam, a Christian fundamentalist, supporting all kinds, taking away rights to women in the country, then suddenly comes as a feminist saying, we're invading Afghanistan for the liberation of women. So, I mean, Bush became a feminist. So this is a, you know, so these are the kind of things that, and then you have a lot of Western feminists falling into the trap and supporting this. You know, when in fact the whole project of intervention, they have nothing to do with women liberation. Look at the consequences now. Look at the situation of women in Afghanistan today. You know, that in terms of just think about the fact that with the warlords in power, the question about violation, rapes, and things like that is just escalating over there. I'm not defending the Taliban, okay, don't get me wrong. But the situation is very bad also. You know, don't come with the story that you're coming to liberate women here. I mean, nothing to do. We have to do with other interests. And they use that to mobilize Western women, you know, to become sympathetic of imperial masculinist aggressions in other places. And this is a very old colonial discourse that has been used historically. Always, you know, white men come to save brown or black women from brown or black male. And this is typical colonial intervention. Since the 1890s, they use these arguments, you know, that they're here because poor woman, black or brown woman, from these black or brown men, and we black men, white men, come to save them. So he just repeats a trope that has been there for a long time. And now with the gay lesbian queer theory, it's been also used more recently to also call or justify imperial interventions in some countries. Okay? And so this is really tricky, because suddenly and that's again the question about critical thinking within the zone of being. If you do critical thinking with the zone of being without taking into consideration the critiques from the zone of not being, you fall into the trap of imperialist colonial logics. You saw that in Marx, I gave examples today, but you see the same thing among Western feminists or Western queer theorists. I don't know if you guys have seen the intervention of Judith Butler last year.
Yeah.
That was a very good intervention here in Berlin, I think it was, no? Yeah. It's on YouTube, it's in German, you should check it out. Which is a fantastic intervention she did here, questioning the Islamophobia and racism of the gay lesbian movement that was organizing that festival here last year, you know, and it was a fantastic intervention, you know, because she was calling on precisely this question of, you know, of how they were instrumentalizing, you know, queer theory and queer critique, you know, to justify racism, which is terrible. She kind of decoded that in her speech, you know. And so I'm saying this because, you know, she's a Western feminist, and look what she say. I mean, I think she's an example of the possibility of a decolonial feminism. The same way I talk about Boaventura Sousa Santos. This is an example. He's a European Portuguese sociologist who is taking seriously the epistemologies of the South. As a matter of fact, he has several books called Epistemologies of the South. You know, he's calling for that, saying we Northern social science have to take seriously the epistemologies of the South. We need to go beyond our colonial theories. And so so this is an example of that possibility. So I'm saying this because the decolonial project is an invitation to everybody. Everybody has something to contribute here. You know, and especially people who are in a zone of being that are able to really transform this zone and push for a political project of decolonization will be an amazing liberatory process for many people around the world too, because in a sense the situation of power here is such that if there is a struggle here that can manage to, in a sense, weaken these kind of structures worldwide, would have an amazing impact in the world at large. And that's why I think that the decolonial struggle in the center of Europe is a fundamental struggle. And this is not a struggle of the Turkish or of the Arabs or of the... It's a struggle of everybody here. And this system is affecting everybody. The problem is that with the racist ideology, they're derailing how people are living the crisis. So you have white working classes now thinking that the problem is the Muslims. German Muslim or French Muslim, or because these are not migrants anymore. You have people who are born and raised here, but you put divide and rule. You put the working classes of Europe today, the white working classes, to fight immigrants and to fight minorities inside the countries and things like that. And then it's not anymore a problem of financial crisis of capitalism. Now it's a problem of all these people taking our jobs away, no? Then, you know, we're going nowhere with that. So if we don't decolonize, and decolonization implies to attack this hegemonic racist, perspective that is really a fundamental issue, you know, in relation to all this struggle that is not allowing for the proper political alliances to happen. Okay. Now, I've seen in Madrid today something very inspiring. In Madrid, in Spain, Jews have 48% of unemployment rate in Spain today. And they have a movement similar to Tahrir Square in Plaza Sol, and now spreading all over Spain, of Jews claiming their rights as people who have no jobs, questioning the way democracy works, because you vote every 4 years, you have no saying in anything else they do. Okay? And this is spreading all over. And the interesting thing about this movement is that these are working class Spanish Jews together with immigrants. They're not playing the card of divide and rule, and now Bobila is, oh, we are unemployed, it's because the Muslims are taking our jobs away, it's because the blacks, it's because the Africans. No, they are together with immigrants. This is very powerful. It's happening now. And I think the rest of Europe is looking at this, especially youth in Europe, who are now hopeless with the financial crisis and high unemployment rates. And I see hope there when you see Spanish youth together with immigrants instead of mobilizing against immigrants. Okay? And this is an amazing thing. Anyway, I'm like shocked, because if you look at the polls of the votes in what happened in Sweden, what happened in Denmark, what happened in Holland, what happened in France, what happened, it's extreme right who is capitalizing from the crisis, because they're instrumentalizing racist discourses, you see, for people to interpret the crisis as scapegoating someone else. And this is a movement that's questioning all of that, you know, and it's coming from the south of Europe, and I hope it's spread all over, anyway.
Okay,
Sabine?
No, I just want to congratulate you, because in 4 years of being here doing my PhD, it's the first time that I see such a thing, people staying here wanting to ask more and more and more questions, and also arguing against for or against.
Most of them with a migrant background. Yes,
but it's not all of them. Yeah, and hopefully not only you, but all the people thinking in this direction could also give such a lecture, not in the Institute of Technology, but in the main buildings of the university, meaning that not only anthropologists or cultural studies just visit this kind of thing. But I myself, I want to thank you, Andrea. This is so much. You came here, plus a psychologist, a political scientist, and I had no idea about this existed as such as a trend in cultural studies. Thank you.
Thank you very much also for having the patience to listen to this kind of crazy discourse.
But if there are some more questions, you say when you're
home. Yeah, I'm not tired. We can continue. It's no problem. You know. It's no problem. There are decolonial movements in France, the indigenous of the Republic. I don't know, you know that. There are decolonial movements, black Dutch movements in Amsterdam, they're in London. This is like something that is happening also inside Europe, you know, and that is going to, sooner or later, is going to catch up, you know, with the situation in Europe. Because, you know, what happened with extreme rights and racist discourses, they have one limit, and that is that they can continue criticizing, they can continue doing this instrumentalization of racism to gain votes. But there's going to be a moment when people will say, okay, where is my job? You know, how is my standard of living going? You know, so this is a, it has a limit there, you know, if it is properly debated. Oh, wow.
No, this is the
email. The email, okay.
No, because this is an email account. If you write there, then I can make a list and we can keep on meeting and making the decolonial group at this institute to start and then making it bigger.
Yeah, my invitation is I can help to bring other people, not from Europe and from outside Europe, that could come here and also do a seminar like I'm doing. Because you see that in this decolonial perspective, it's very heterogeneous. What I'm saying, you will hear other people saying similar thing but with a different twist, you see? And even different from me, and even with differences with me. So it's good that you hear that too. So I'm telling Andrea to that, why don't we take advantage of this moment to really invite other people that are in Europe and others that are outside Europe, you know, to come here and do the same thing I'm doing here. One. And second, I'm ready to come back and do like a seminar, like, you know, something more like 1 week or 2 weeks that we can come and because right now I throw a lot of information to you in three sessions that is like overwhelming. Maybe we should go in more detail into all these questions, you know, and do like a seminar. Visiting professor seminar, whatever, and do a 1 week thing. I told her I don't have to stay in a hotel, I can stay with someone else if the money's not there. I don't care, really. But we can get together again and go over in depth into a lot of the things I throw here very fast and, you know, like brushes, you know. And we can go deeper into these questions, you know.
Because the first step is to build the group also at this institute, and there will be a seminar in the winter, and we can deepen on these things. But also, I think we have to take this out, like you said, not just in the European ethnology, but I am here, so I can offer the space here. For example, if we can do this in the space of, I don't know, here in the College of Gender Studies, for example.
I'm not here in Berlin, I'm actually doing my dissertation as well, and also, yeah.
Ah, okay, but I think you said,
if you have context there,
or look for other spaces so that this same seminar can find, take place, and not just here, but somewhere else. If you are interested, and then take it to the main rooms, as you said, but then we have to go step by step to get this, the main room for another seminar.
You were raising your hand.
Yeah, did you organize?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. That's very